Here we are, Mum.
It's a graveyard, Latimer.
You said you wanted somewhere with more atmosphere, Mum. And this is very atmospheric. I've even managed to secure suitably spooky weather.
It's a graveyard, Latimer. I'm sure the poor people here wouldn't appreciate us taking tea and giggling in a place of rest.
Oh, there aren't any people buried here, Mum. This is a metaphysical graveyard, where ideas are laid to rest.
That grave looks disturbed, as if someone's dug it up recently.
Oh yes, Mum. That's where the concept of beards being fashionable was buried.
Oh, and what's this one over here?
Hope for the future, Mum.
It looks like it's been recently buried.
Yes, they put it on this new plot next to Truth.
And there's Justice. And is that the...
I think it's time for a spot of tea, don't you, Mum?
God, yes.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been finding the latest Black Mirrors a little too light and fluffy. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. A graveyard is far from the first place that comes to mind as an ideal location, but at least we will have tea to keep us warm, and we've brought lots of chairs so no one has to sit in that disturbing mist that is rising as I speak. I think we should all huddle in tight around the teapot and stay in the lantern light, just in case.
I'm sorry to disturb you, but your guest has arrived. Ms. Marika Nikon.
Splendid. Let's see her calling card.
There isn't a card as such, Mum.
No card? Is this becoming a fashion?
I believe so, Mum. Would you like me to bury it?
No, Latimer, just give me the card. The non-card, whatever it is.
It's a magical raven's feather, Mum.
Ooh, it's writing in the air. I must add one of those to my Christmas list. Marika Nikon, author. Jolly good. Send her over, Latimer.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Marika Nikon is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller debut novel, This Is Where It Ends, which follows four teens during a school shooting.
Ms. Marika Nikon, Mum.
Hello, Marika. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Would you care for some tea?
I would love some.
How do you take your tea?
Actually, if you have some lemon and ginger, I've been a bit under the weather, so...
I do, actually. We now take a basket of different herbal teas with us now when we go to take tea with everyone, so that I don't impose my English breakfast tea on everyone.
No, I was just about to say, I actually do like English breakfast, but with the weather as it is, some ginger is a lot better.
Yes, would you like me to add a dash of honey?
I would love that.
Awesome. It's very nice for colds and recovery, I think, this tea. So I will pour, and I was wondering if you would like some apple crumble and custard.
Always.
That's my sentiment exactly, but especially on cold and dank days in graveyards, I thought we needed something comforting.
Oh, absolutely. Any visit to a graveyard is made so much better with apple crumble.
Definitely. Now, I hope you don't mind the chickens over there. They won't bother us, but I just wanted to check that you're not allergic to feathers or anything like that.
I should be fine, I hope.
Brilliant. In my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I brought along a collection of medieval magic spells, specifically magic spells from the 15th century.
But real ones?
Belgium somewhere. Yeah, real ones. I'm not entirely sure they work, but someone wrote them down as being medieval spells, and I've been researching them for a story I'm working on. So I just like to carry them around and see if I can use them from time to time.
But have you tested them? The scientist in me is very excited. have you conducted experiments?
The spell I'm mainly focusing on right now is a love spell, so I haven't quite found the right target for that yet.
Oh, dangerous, as you know, practically every story tells us anything to do with love is very, very dangerous.
It's fun though.
That too. I have a question about your novel, This Is Where It Ends. And in your novel, it follows four teens during a school shooting. Now, I know that you did a lot of research for your novel. You talk about that on your website. But I was wondering how you prepared yourself for writing about a subject which is so emotionally, socially and politically charged.
That's actually a good question, because I don't think I did as much as I probably could have done when I started out writing the book. I started out writing it because I was fascinated by the subject and thoroughly unclear about how something that harrowing can be almost normalized to a sense that people just expect it to happen and don't blink when it does and don't really respond to it in a way that I would expect people to respond, because it's just another school shooting and these things happen and what do you do? So for me, starting out writing the book, it was mostly an exercise in trying to understand what was going on and what situations like that do to teens primarily, but people in general. And for me, it started out as a story, and I didn't quite realize until I was midway through how much it affected me as a writer to be working on it that intensely. And I think that was mostly clear in the research that I did and the way that I would spend days on end reading about school shootings and watching documentaries and listening to survivors speak. And I would just need to take a moment after that, or even just several days, and step away and surround myself with sunshine and friends and happy things just to be able to deal with it all. But I never really considered that a part of the process when I started writing the book. It was only something that I realized I needed whilst I was writing it.
It's interesting you say that, because a friend of mine, Adam Neville, who's a horror writer, has talked, I think it was in one of his acceptance speeches, about what he went through researching the novel for which he won a British Fantasy Award, and how he had to read about these awful, awful murders taking place in a house. It's a very famous serial killer story in the UK. And he was reading, like you, immersing himself in it, until one day his wife said, look, I think you need to have a break. I think you need to step back from this, because it was really, really starting to eat him up and to really affect his mood. And it's really interesting hearing you talk about how you needed to step back and leave that world, but you have to go back into it to write something authentic. I find that a really interesting tension.
The thing we do with, at least the thing I do when I watch films and read books, is like, if it gets too harrowing, it's easy to say, oh, it's just fiction, or it's made up, it's not as bad as that in real life, which is obviously an easy escape and in most cases a lie. But it helps to deal with stuff that you're not always emotionally equipped to deal with. And then researching things like these, you can't say that. You can't go back to it and say, oh, it's only, like, none of this would ever happen, because you're basing it on too many occasions where it actually did. And you're, like, all of this influences real people. Stepping away from that is good. Also, just clearing your mind and, I guess, finding a way to not so much ignore it, but accept it and then approach it again. Because you do have to go back into it and approach it as honestly and as truthfully as you can. And in that sense, I don't think that, like, you have to step away from it, but you also have to continue feeling what's going on to be able to tell the story as respectfully as possible.
Yeah, I don't know if you feel the same, but I kind of feel the same way about what's happening in the world at the moment, that you have to be aware of what's going on and to maintain empathy and understanding. But it's so taxing at the moment, because things are so awful, that there is also that need to kind of step back for mental health, if nothing else.
Oh, absolutely. I find myself being drawn to writing in a way that I've experienced before, but not quite to this level. Like, I've always thought of writing as a way to understand the world and understand what's going on. But for me, it's almost as necessary as breathing right now, just to be able to stay upright and deal with everything and not give in to almost this sense of despair, I think.
Absolutely. That is that's a word that has been in my head a lot over recent weeks. And the feeling that we have to kind of stop ourselves from falling into that, that it's an active struggle, it seems, for me anyway at the moment, to not let the despair take hold, because it would be very easy for it to do so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. So I understand that you speak many, many languages. I used to speak French and Spanish, but it's mostly gone now. It's very rusty. It's been a few years. But one of the things that I really, really loved about learning other languages, and I would love it if everybody learned other languages, because it broadens the mind to have different linguistic experiences. And one of the things that I used to get really excited and nerdy about were differences between my native language and the languages I was learning. One example of this was when I was studying L'Étranger by Camus, mm-hmm. and my French teacher talking about how L'Étranger is used to mean stranger and foreigner and outsider in like several different meanings in French, but in English we just like pillage all other languages and we just absorb the words into our language, and so we can kind of talk about things in a very exact and granular way. There's less room for one word meaning multiple things in the same kind of nuanced way as it could be enjoyed in French. And I was wondering, with you knowing so many languages, have you got a kind of a favourite thing that you enjoy as a difference between your native tongue and a language that you've learned after obviously acquiring your own native language?
Let me just start by saying that I would love for more people to learn more languages, because I absolutely agree that it's helps broaden the mind and it helps understand different cultures and different people. And one thing that always intrigued me, aside from learning languages, I also spend a lot of time studying how different languages developed. I mainly studied medieval history, but there's obviously a huge shift in this kind of, well, basically a shift from oral history to written history during that time. And I loved seeing how the way we use language influences the way we think about the world and vice versa. So I don't necessarily geek out about differences in language, but I do geek out about like the way we use language and the way it signifies our understanding of the world, basically. In that sense, it's also just really interesting to be writing fiction in a language that isn't my native tongue, because I found my writing style changes depending on the language I use, but also the way I look at the world changes just ever so slightly, and the way I look at myself even. Like, there's things I would do and say in English that I wouldn't do and say in Dutch, because I'm a slightly different person in English than I am in Dutch.
I love that. That's so fascinating. Is there an example that's kind of easy to encapsulate, or is it just a kind of a broader feeling? It's just a sense?
I think it's mostly a broader feeling, but it's definitely also a case of my being more outspoken in English. I tend to be a little more reserved in Dutch. I tend to be a little quieter. Apparently my voice changes, which is really weird. That's not something I can easily judge for myself, but people around me have told me that. For me, I don't know. I think English is very much a language I acquired through travel and through fiction and through adventures, both in real life and various books. So I don't necessarily bring the same baggage as I would bring to Dutch, and it's always been a slightly more adventurous language to me.
Oh, I love this so much. It really excites me. You're in an interesting position, having your novel translated into multiple languages. Have you been far more involved with the translation process than most authors might be? Or have you just said, no, you do that, that's fine?
I've mostly not been that involved, in at least in the translation so far, with the only exception almost logically being Dutch. I didn't translate the book myself. I got a lot of questions about that, but like one of the reasons why I didn't is, well, A, I'm not a translator, and that's an art in itself that I respect greatly, and I wouldn't dare to try because I would be rubbish at it. But also because the book would literally change, because Dutch would mean having different tools, and the rhythm of the language is different, and the melody, and the way I can use words. So it's probably not a good idea for me to actually translate my own books, because I would end up with vastly different stories. I mean, I'm quite intrigued to try it on a short story maybe at some point, just to see what would happen. But yeah, when it comes to the actual translation of the book, for the Dutch version, I read along and presumably thoroughly spooks out the translator, because that just sounds like a nightmare job to me, translating a book into someone's native language.
Yes. What a lot of pressure.
I know. So, but she did an amazing job, and I'm so grateful for that particular translation. It was also such a weird process to me to read along and to see these words I'd written translated into a language I know so well. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, I started out writing in Dutch, and it's been many, many years since I tried, but there were occasionally, while reading the translation, there were these phrases and these turns of phrases and a certain kind of rhythm that I recognized from way back when I wrote in Dutch, so that it did feel like a sort of homecoming in a way that I didn't anticipate until I saw the translation.
That's brilliant. So you mentioned having studied the medieval period, and you have a master's in medieval studies. And at the moment, it feels like there are some very dark aspects of history that are repeating themselves. And I was wondering, with your knowledge of the medieval period, is there a thing about the medieval period that you wish that everybody could know, that could help us in the present day, or perhaps a misconception that you would love to have corrected perfectly with your knowledge of the medieval period?
Oh goodness, so much. The thing I love about the medieval period is not so much this idea of the Dark Ages that we have, and that's been repeated over and over again in movies and popular portrayals of the Middle Ages, but it's the sense of building a world and the sense of trying to understand what's going on. The thing that struck me the most while studying the medieval period is the idea that people in the Middle Ages thought of themselves as modern, as we do now. And I think that's just such an interesting insight into, we keep thinking that we've learned from history and that history is this linear line, linear progression towards some sort of enlightenment. And I love the idea that throughout history, every single person thought of themselves as modern in some kind of way. And I think that there's so much about the medieval period that's absolutely rubbish, and I wouldn't want to go there. But there's also so much in the sense of exploring who we are and what we want to do, at least in medieval Europe and in the cities in particular, where the type of society that we want to build is one where very many people from very many, many experiences and backgrounds come together. And I think there's some really cool examples of that from 1,000 years ago. And it's not just something that we've been doing now. We have this idea of the Middle Ages as being predominantly white and having knights and kings wander around and poor peasants, and that's about it. But there's so much more to medieval Europe in that era. The one thing that really struck me is I have a bachelor's degree in philosophy, and I also studied some medieval philosophy, although I wouldn't necessarily call myself an expert there. But it's interesting to see how much of science as it is now and our understanding of philosophy came from the Muslim world and came from the Jewish world and came from people who actually preserved that knowledge while most of Western Europe were almost busy bashing each other's heads. So yes, there's always been that sense of sharing knowledge and building towards whatever sense of modernity there is that I think would be great for people to know more about, because I think some kind of humility in terms of our position in history would help a lot of people understand that we aren't just modern and we're not just working on progress. This is an endless experiment that we keep repeating and that we keep building on. And we're not so much better than the people who lived 1,000 years ago or 100 years ago, but we're still continuously working on that same human experiment. And it would help to see that that's been the same journey all along.
I think that's a very, very poignant thing to say. Very much so. You're very well travelled, and I was wondering if there's anything that is widely used or done in the Netherlands that you would like to see adopted in other countries far more than it is today.
You mean aside from eating licorice?
Any aspect of life in the Netherlands. But you know, maybe something that would be perhaps more beneficial to humankind. But, you know, people would, I should think, argue very passionately about the merits of licorice. But I don't know if there's anything about the way that, I don't know, that your government works, any kind of sustainable building practices. I don't know. I'm pulling things off the top of my head here, things that I'm very passionate about. So, yeah, is there anything that you're used to having that when you travel is not there in other countries and makes you think, but why not? This is really sensible.
I think for me, that would go back to language education.
Mm.
It always baffles me to go abroad and to go to places where, or predominantly English-speaking countries, where most people will only be fluent in one language. And that isn't to say that the Dutch are necessarily all fluent in more than one. We'd like to think so. And I definitely thought I was after high school and after college. And then I tried my hand at actually writing fiction in English and decided that I had a long, long way to go. But having language education in multiple foreign languages from a relatively early age, it has been so incredibly beneficial for me. Yeah, it would benefit so many people. So I'd love to see that practice adapted in other places. I mean, I'd also like to see it develop in the Netherlands, because mostly we're focused on English and German and French. And I think it'd also be really interesting to add like Chinese to that, or Arabic, or languages that we come in touch with on a regular basis, but that still feels so foreign because they're not part of our framework of understanding.
Yes, definitely. And different roots, you know, not not Germanic languages.
Yes.
And having something from a completely different root. If I had like 5 lifetimes that I could live over, I definitely would want to go and learn Chinese and Arabic. It's just something which is so appealing to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Study something that is so embedded in a fundamentally different culture. That would be so exciting. And a different way of writing as well, a different alphabet. It would be utterly fascinating.
Now, I studied Japanese for a couple of years, and I really do hate that thing where your brain goes, oh, you studied a language for a couple of years and then you didn't use it for 2 months. Isn't that a shame? Now you've lost it all.
Hello, yes. I'm sure there's a gravestone somewhere here for Emma speaking French fluently and Emma speaking Spanish, because I did do that once.
Oh. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a few for me too. Just learning to almost quite literally wrap your minds around a different structure a different language structure and different types of writing as well. It was fascinating, and it taught me so much more about Japanese culture than any kind of book would, in the sense that, again, I honestly believe that language reflects our deepest understanding of culture in many ways. So it was so fascinating to do, and there are so many more languages, and Arabic definitely as one of them, that I would love to spend the time to study, because I think it would help understand. And I also think that, generally speaking, all of us who speak English have this almost quite arrogant presumption at times that the rest of the world will understand us, and they just have to come to us. And living in a town with many cultures, I think that goes both ways. So I'd love to, at least try to gain some fluency, not even necessarily, but I'd like to be conversant in a few more languages at some point.
Mm. I'd like you to imagine that suddenly all of the cats in the world declared that you were their queen. what would be your first what would be your first royal decree as queen of all cats?
Oh my goodness, that sounds like so much fun. Could they possibly overthrow some governments for me? Specifically some governments that seem to be turning quite supremacist in recent days.
Yes, I would like to support that, and I welcome you as our new overlord.
Perfect.
When I have a guest who comes to tea, I like to ask online if there's anyone who isn't lucky enough to have tea with us, if they have a question that they would like to ask. And the very lovely Minika has asked a question that I would like to put to you. And she's asked, what about the reception for This Is Where It Ends has surprised you the most? And were the reactions in different countries surprisingly different?
The obvious answer to that is I never expected it to have this type of reception, in the sense that hitting a bestseller list is this faraway dream that I had for 40 years down the line, maybe. So I never expected that to happen with a debut novel, and to see it gain that much traction, and to see it become a book that is used in schools to discuss school shootings and discuss community, I think, and the way we all relate to each other. And that's been intensely, that's why you write books, in a way that, maybe I should say it like this, I write books in the hope that they will help people, will help readers understand a little bit more about themselves, which books certainly do for me, and maybe inspire them to go out and tell their own stories. So to see that that's something that's happening in school settings, for example, is incredibly cool. I'd hoped it might be the case like that, but I'd never quite expected it. So that's definitely the most humbling and surprising part of it. And in terms of different reactions in different countries, it's been interesting to see the way Dutch readers respond to the book, which is, I think, far more influenced by that same fascination that I had when I started writing the book, in the sense of this is something that's happening, and it's happening an ocean away, but it's still something that we see, and it's something that we are maybe worried about or curious about or want to understand. And in that sense, it's a far more, I don't know, it's as if you're, quite literally writing about something that's foreign to them. Mm. Whereas when I talk about it with readers in the US, it's obviously something that's part of their lives and very immediate. And it's hard to quantify that response in what it means exactly, but it's a different type of conversation you have. And it's been really interesting to see those differences.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds it. Moving on to something a little bit sillier. I was Wondering if you would be able to tell me, if you could pick a song, which one would be the theme tune to your life, so that we can ask the chickens over there, which are quite remarkable creatures, if they could sing it for us. So it's a hard thing to do, to pick one song, but if you had to pick one song to be the theme tune of your life, which one would it be?
When I started out studying medieval history, I had to write a personal essay, and that started out with, I think quite literally, I always wanted to be a knight when I grew up, and I still want to do that, mm-hmm. but since I can't actually like go around on a horse and all the sword and hit people, studying medieval history felt like the closest thing. And in that sense, King and Lionheart by Of Monsters and Men always felt really appropriate to me.
Excellent. Okay then, little chickens, could you sing King and Lionheart by Of Monsters and Men for Marika, please? And there they go.
Amazing. Oh, it's amazing. I love it.
Readers and fans of your work, what can they look forward to in coming months? Have you got any other books coming out? Is there anything on the horizon for us to look forward to?
I'm working on a few things at the moment. I just finished another book, and I'm not entirely sure what I can and can't tell about that. I'm also working on a few stories for anthologies. I'm really excited about that. So it's been fun going back to short fiction, because that's where I started many years ago. It turns out that short fiction brings out the historical fiction writer in me, which Ooh. I never anticipated. And I always swore up and down that I would never write historical fiction, because as a historian, I get really obsessed by facts and getting it as right as possible. And I didn't feel like I could ever get to that point with fiction. But it turns out writing short pieces has really inspired me to go that distance after all. I just finished a story that's set in the early 20th century in the US, and that deals with disability and the Supreme Court and eugenics. So it's fun. as one does. And I'm at the moment researching a collection of 15th century magic spells for another story. I started that research in grad school, and I'm sure that my professors will be delighted to know that it's now turning into a YA story.
Marvelous.
But yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. So aside from writing contemporary YA in book form, that's also something I've been exploring and discovering. I'm really excited about it.
Fantastic. I'm just going to check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty, but I do believe there is some more crumble and custard if you would like to take some away with you to heat up when you get home.
Absolutely.
So that just leaves me to thank you very much for coming and taking tea with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do take care as you go through the graveyard. It's a bit creepy here, isn't it?
Looks all right.
Good. Perhaps I'm just, you know, a bit more sensitive to rising mist and the cold, dank conditions around us. But I'm not going to dwell on that too much. You just hold that apple crumble and custard close, and Latimer will show you the right way out. So take care now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
This way, Mum.
I've been thinking, Latimer, you had better not be tricking her into tripping into an open grave.
As I said, Mum, only ideas are buried here, not people. Although, if we could distill and then bury the idea of her, it would have the advantage of removing her from existence entirely.
What? No! We need more people like Marika in the world.
Hypothetically speaking, of course.
Do I need to follow her out of the graveyard to make sure she gets home safely?
I wouldn't advise it, Mum. You might get hit by the scythe.
What? Wait, who is that creepy man over there?
The Reaper of Ideas, Mum. He may have heard that she had an idea for a new book, Hypothetically speaking, of course.
He's going to steal her book idea?
Just the one idea, Mum.
Well, why does he need the scythe, then?
Well, he has to get to the ideas somehow, Mum.
Oh, Latimer, what have you done?
Renting a graveyard is expensive, Mum. And as you know, these are tough times.
I'm going to go over there and put myself between them. Wait, what? Did she just turn into a flock of birds?
An unkindness of ravens, I believe, Mum.
What's the collective noun for troublesome butlers, I wonder?
I'm quite sure such a noun has never proven necessary, Mum. What is the collective noun for authors?
I believe it's a moan of authors. Hold on, if Marika is safe, doesn't that mean the Reaper of Ideas is going to come after one of mine instead?
Fear not, Mum. I gave him the idea you had for an epic romance series.
But I've never wanted to write romance.
Indeed, Mum.
Well then, as Latimer packs up the tea things, I'd like to raise my teacup to James McStravick and William Hay, the most recent members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy. Latimer, do we have a resurrection spell somewhere in the hamper?
I'm afraid we had to use it on your husband's career, Mum.
No, I just told you it had died, so you'd stop leaving horrible reviews on Amazon.
Mum! You lied to me! And I do hope you're not going to use the resurrection spell on the idea that we'll all have proper hoverboards this year.
No, I'm going to go and dig up hope for the future. I'm sure we can breathe some life back into it. Now, prepare the festive tea layer, Latimer. It's almost time for our advent calendar.
Oh, no.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.